books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, another festive treat, as we talk to Rachel Greenlaw about her debut novel, One Christmas Morning. Plus, we find the secret history of fairy tales from Nick Jummer and find some brand new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. All that and more on today's Read On. In Rachel Greenlaw's debut novel, One Christmas Morning, we meet Eva and James. The moment Eva locked eyes with James over a library bookshelf, she knew she'd found her soulmate. Over 10 years, they fell in love, got married, and made plans to start a family, until everything changed one Christmas 3 years ago, and they've been drifting apart ever since. Eva hopes a friend's Christmas party at an old manor house in Cornwall will give them the chance to reconnect, but the last thing she expects is to wake up on Christmas morning in the body of a different guest. As Eva's forced to keep reliving Christmas Day from the perspectives of those closest to her, she realises just how much her life has fallen off track. I'll talk to author Rachel Greenlaw in a moment, but first, the audio version of One Christmas Morning is read by Ashley Tucker.
I am surrounded by cardboard boxes. There are piles of them heaped up all around me in an arc on the newly laid, slightly dusty shop floor. And all I can do is close my eyes, lean back against them and wish I could wind time forward. A week would do, maybe a fortnight. Then all the items in these boxes would be arranged on the shelves, scattered artfully across the middle tables, and customers would be wandering in and out, arms piled high with throws and candle holders. I allow that image to sink in for a moment. Isn't that what you're supposed to do so a dream becomes real? Visualise it? But it's not long before the cold seeps in through my jeans and I throw myself forward with a sigh. It's 5 days before we open. 5 days before my dream becomes a reality, and all I feel is hot, stifling panic. My phone rings and I force myself to get up, hurriedly rustling through the open boxes, turning in a circle on the heels of my perfectly white trainers. There. It's on the new counter. I lunge for it, swiping it open as I catch the name. James? I got the Thai. They didn't have the beef massaman, so I got chicken instead. Should be another... His tinny voice slips away, and I picture him shaking back his sleeve, checking his watch. 20 minutes? James, the thing is, I... My words stick in my throat. Excuses glued to the roof of my mouth. There is a pause. A beat of silence. You forgot, didn't you? A wash of shame fills my chest, and I close my eyes. We were meant to get a takeaway tonight, just me and him. Alone in our flat so we could catch up, refuel, have a date night like an actual husband and wife like we used to, but of course I forgot. As I got the last load of scent diffusers on the shelves for the launch, another arrived, then Diana called to say there was a delay with the printed paper bags, then suddenly it was dark outside and all I could do was sit on the floor, just sit and stare at nothing, my mind filling with a tiredness that sleep can't cure.
So 3 years ago, the events over Christmas left Eva heartbroken. She had buried herself in work ever since, neglecting all the relationships that were important in her life. But this Christmas, when the book opens, Eva is preparing her shop launch for her business. She's very excited about it. She's worked really hard to get there, but she's expected to attend a house party in the moorlands of North Cornwall with her husband and her best friends. When she arrives, her husband issues an ultimatum. If she leaves the house party, they're through. But Eva feels she has to return to her shop launch and puts everything she's been working towards first. She leaves at midnight, but finds someone blocking her way in the middle of the road. Someone extremely beloved to her who died 3 Christmases before. Eva then wakes up back in Penhallow on Christmas morning, but not as herself, as somebody else. And what follows is a kind of Groundhog Day scenario where Eva keeps waking up in the bodies of different guests at the house party. And she has to work out from these repeated Christmas days how to fix things and how to find this work-life balance that's been so elusive to her before she loses the people that are most important to her in her life.
I clear my throat. I'll be back in an hour. Give me an hour and I'll get all this put away in the stockroom. I can pop back in afterwards after we've had dinner. Eva. What? He huffs an exasperated breath. I can keep it warm in the oven. Don't get back too late, yeah? James, I'm so... But the line has already gone dead. A laugh claws at my throat, short and bitter, as I drop my mobile phone back on the counter, staring blearily around at the tumble of boxes, the dustpan full of dust by the door, the till still blinking angrily, not yet set up. I feel that sharp pain again, that insistent prickle in the centre of my chest. This is all I wanted. This is what I've been building towards for the past 3 years. This shop, with its double-fronted sage-green framed windows, its casually rustic timber flooring. I take a deep, rattling breath and reach for the nearest shelf. I run my hand over the photo frames, the textured napkins, letting the feel of fabric and wood ground me, anchor me. It reminds me I've got this far, that I could be enough if I push harder, try harder. I nod to myself, straightening a set of 4 white napkins, smoothing them down until they are perfect again. It's all worth it. He'll see.
And where did the idea for the book come from?
Well, actually, this has never happened before and it hasn't happened since, but the idea kind of arrived like a lightning bolt. One October morning, I was in the kitchen doing the dishes and I just suddenly had like the full pitch, the characters in my head, and I scrambled for my phone to write everything down. And then I locked myself in my office for 2 days and wrote 15,000 words. And then I wrote the rest of the first draft in like 3 weeks. It was messy and it was short, but I had a full first draft. And in hindsight, I kind of know where this story has come from. I wrote it during one of the lockdowns. And I think that really comes across in the kind of isolated setting of the moorland and the fact that Eva keeps returning to Penhallow and she can't get away from the house. There's also the repetitive nature of the book, the kind of Groundhog Day feel, which was very much how I felt during lockdown. And also the fact that it's all about work-life balance. And like, I definitely grappled with that. And I think many people do, especially having young children. So in hindsight, it's very clear why I wrote this book and where the ideas came from. But at the time, it just popped into my head and it was very exciting.
Is Penhallow a real place?
It's not, but it is actually based on a hotel on St Mary's on the Isles of Scilly, St Mary's Hall Hotel. If anyone was to look it up, it's like a granite manor house. And if you walk inside and walk through the hallway and the front rooms, it looks just how I imagine Penhallow to look.
Now, you grew up in North Cornwall. Is the setting for the book your childhood's surroundings?
It is, yeah. I grew up in Launceston, which is in like right on the Cornwall Devon border. And like at a lot of points around Launceston, you can look out and you're just literally surrounded by moorland. And in the winter, you can just see all the snow on the surrounding moorland. And to get out of Launceston, it's quite tricky. There's no like train, there's limited buses. So I very much grew up going on walks in like beautiful moorland settings. So it is very much inspired by where I grew up.
Now, was it quite a tricky thing to write? You know, you're revisiting the same scenes, but from a different character's point of view.
Yes. So it was tricky in revisions because I had to go back through in meticulous detail and make sure that all the dialogue matched up and all the movements of the characters. So there's a particular scene where two characters are speaking to each other, and then you see them from a different perspective of someone watching them have that conversation. So I had to make sure it all matched up. But then I went in and I broke the rules when Eva decided to break the rules of what's happening during that day.
Do you read the dialogue aloud to make sure it flows?
I did a little bit, yeah, just to make sure that it all made sense and that it felt like someone talking.
No, that's great. Thanks. As I move around the entrance hall, my phone still shows nothing. No signal, no Wi-Fi. Zip. I frown, standing on tiptoes to hold it high above my head. Nothing. Do you know where I can get service here? Oh, there's none. And the internet's down. Something about a faulty connection at the exchange? Hallie shrugs. Anyway, you can get a signal at the pub and Wi-Fi, but it's a bit of a hike across the fields. Not that we need it, right? I smile, laughing nervously. No Wi-Fi. All phone signal. This was not good. Not good at all. What about the socials, the scheduled posts? I pocket my phone, avoiding eye contact with Hallie. I'm on edge, balancing on a knife blade. And the smallest breath of wind, the slightest flip in my plans, unbalances me. I need to be alone. I need to refocus, that's all. Hallie reaches for my suitcase, but I shake my head. Absolutely not. No need to put your back out on the first day. I follow after her, feeling like a lemon as we climb the red carpeted treads to the first floor. Glancing up, I can see the staircase is less regal leading up to the second floor, but no less festooned in ivy and twinkly lights. It's all so decadent, expectant, a house waiting for something to happen.
Now, talking of reading aloud, the audio version is read by Ashley Tucker. Did you have a choice of the narrator?
I did, and I was so thrilled when I heard Ashley's voice reel. Narrators for audiobooks are incredibly important to me because I do listen to a lot of audiobooks myself, and I wanted One Christmas Morning to feel incredibly soothing and the kind of book that you kind of listen to and feel cozy. So when I listened to Ashley's voice, it just clicked into place. She's very softly spoken. She's got a lovely cadence about her voice, and it felt just right for narrating One Christmas Morning.
Did you not fancy trying to narrate it yourself?
No.
Now,
I don't think I'd be very good at that.
you said you listened to audiobooks yourself. Is that a recent thing?
I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and when I'm really excited about a book I'm reading, maybe on a Kindle or as a paperback, I'll switch between audiobook and physical book so that I don't have to put it down. So if I'm like going to the gym or going for a walk or just doing like folding laundry, I can keep reading it. But also, I do listen to audiobooks specifically just for the joy of listening to them. For example, Carrie Soto Is Back by Taylor Jenkins Reid, I think is perfect to read on audio because it's got this lovely rhythm to it with the tennis matches. So I think actually the audio books are really, really important, and they've got a big place in my life.
Now, one thing we don't get if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you describe the cover for us?
Oh, of course. Okay, so I've got it in my hand right now, and the background is a navy blue, which fades to a royal blue by the bottom of the cover. We've got the tagline, One Day to Change Fate, in white at the top, and then the title, One Christmas Morning, which is picked out in gold. There's also a scattering of gold and white stars around the title, and also the illustrations of Eva and James at the bottom, with Eva walking towards a haze of gold stars, and then my name at the bottom picked out in gold.
Yeah, James is sort of walking away from Eva on the cover.
Yes.
It's a book that can be enjoyed any time of the year, even though it has Christmas in the title.
Yes. Do you know what? I've thought about this since. Why did I pick Christmas? The reason is that Christmas can be such an emotive time of year for families and friends, and there can be a lot of drama. It can be a time of self-reflection. It's a really poignant time of the year, which was a big reason why I chose Christmas Day specifically. But really, I could have picked another holiday period. I could have picked like an August bank holiday. It might not have had that same poignancy, but it can be enjoyed different times of the year because it's got a real book club kind of feel to it. But I am glad that I went for Christmas because I really did lean into the kind of theme of A Christmas Carol and kind of taking away lessons from someone who's been important to us in the past.
Now, your debut novel, was it difficult to get it published?
Yes. Yes and no. I have been writing for the longest time, just like so many authors who are about to debut. I think I tried actively writing books and trying to find an agent and a publisher for about 5 years before I signed with my agent, Maddalena Cavaciuti. We worked on the book together after I'd worked on it extensively myself, and she took it on submission, and I'd been on submission twice before with a previous agent and got nowhere. So I had very low expectations. But then we had the interest from HarperCollins within 6 weeks. And after that, they bought the book. And I honestly couldn't believe it. I still can't believe it, even though it's sitting on the desk next to me.
Now, what I would normally ask at the end is what's next. But I know what's next because I've read a little synopsis. Tell us about Compass and Blade.
So Compass and Blade, it's like my love letter to the islands I live on and the sea. It's about a girl called Mira who lives on a fantasy version of kind of similar to the islands that I live on. She lives on an island of wreckers. They lure ships in intentionally and wreck them, and that's how they survive in their community. And Mira finds that one day, the Watch, they capture her father on the beach. She's desperate to save him, so she goes on a journey across the ocean to find something that she believes her mother has buried in the ocean to save him with. But what she finds along the way is that she knows less about herself than she believed, and she knows less about the world around her than she actually thought she did. And she will uncover lots of secrets, lies, and there will be lots of bargains and betrayals. And it's extremely romantic, magical, and I loved writing it. And the first book in that trilogy is out on February 29th from HarperCollins Children's Books.
We'll keep our ear out for the audio version of that, but for now, One Christmas Morning is available in print as an ebook and in audio as read by Ashley Tucker, both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. And Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert. Thanks so much for having me on.
And Rachel will be back at the end of the show with Books of Your Life. We'll be diving into the secret history of fairy tales after we listen to two brand new audiobooks, available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books.
If you're in the mood for a crime novel, HarperCollins have gifted us The Clearing by Simon Toyne.
Adele violently shakes out another black bin liner. Where the hell was Maddie? She scans the campsite, looking for her sister through the bone-coloured bell tents and artfully rusted camper vans, staggering closer, wearing last night's clothes and a blank expression. But all she sees are a few casualties from the Midsummer's Eve revelries lying on the ground where they'd passed out the night before, smoke from dying fires drifting across them like gun smoke from a lost battle. It's a mess. It was always going to be a mess, and it all needs cleaning up before 11 when the council refuse lorry arrives. That's why she'd asked her older and supposedly wiser sister to help this morning. Why she'd allowed her to crash on her floor in exchange for a promise that she would help with the post-Midsummer's Eve clear-up. And yet, here, she very much was not. Adele wrenches the lid off one of the bins, her long brown hair scraped back and already sticking to her skin with the rising heat of the day, her thin, wiry body nut brown from having to work outside all summer. She recoils at the stench that billows out along with a squadron of angry flies, then violently twists the top of the bag into a knot, imagining it's Maddie's neck. "I'll be there," Maddie had said. "I won't stay out long, but I promise to meet someone."
Women are going missing. Something deadly lurks in the forest around Cinderfield. Locals put the unusually high number of disappearances down to transients or runaways. Some even blame the Cinderman, a figure of local legend rumoured to haunt the woods looking for unsuspecting victims. Forensic specialist Lawton Rees doesn't believe in monsters. Already investigating the area's history of missing women, news of the latest runaway, Maddie Fryer, brings her to Cinderfield to find out the truth. But from the gruff leader of an off-grid commune to the mysterious Earl who presides over the crumbling abbey in the heart of the forest, everyone in Cinderfield has something to hide. As Lawton searches for answers with the help of DCI Tannehill Khan back in London, someone is watching, cataloguing her every move, preparing to do anything to keep their dark secrets from coming to light.
Adele lifts the heavy, stinking bag out of the bin and dumps it on the ground, ready to be picked up by the honey wagon, an old, repurposed electric milk float Maddie should be driving, but obviously isn't because she's not here. She fits a new liner into the bin and lets the lid fall with a loud bang. Movement catches her eye in a dark pool of shadow beneath a sycamore tree, as a man wearing a Cinderman costume of charcoal-blackened sacking lifts his head, roused by the sound of the banging bin. "Morning," Adele calls to him, loud and bright. He winces, as if the word is made of sharp metal, then looks up, eyes screwed tight against the brightness, trying to remember how he ended up under this tree. He looks so wretched with bits of twig and leaves in the greasy tangle of his hair that Adele pulls the bottle of water from her belt and tosses it over. "Drink," she commands. He reaches to pick it up, spots a puddle of puke on the grass nearby, with flies lined up along the edge of it, and turns away, blowing his cheeks out as if he's about to add to it. He unscrews the cap and takes a tiny sip of water before lying slowly back down on the ground, hugging the bottle to his chest. Adele yanks another bin liner from her belt and marches past him, heading to the next overflowing bin that needs emptying, scanning the campsite for Maddie again as she works the phone from her pocket. No missed calls, no texts. She taps the screen to unlock it, but it won't respond to her fingers inside the rubber glove, so she shakes her hand violently until the glove flies off, finds the last number she dialed, and calls it again, her fingers leaving steamy fingerprints on the screen. She holds the phone to her ear and screws her nose up against the foul smell of rubber and rotting garbage coming from her hand. "Hey, leave me a message and I'll call you back." Maddie's smiling, childish-sounding voice cuts in without it ringing, which shows that her phone is still switched off. Adele disconnects without leaving a message because she's left several already and scrolls through her contacts instead, looking for the names of people who might have been with Maddie last night, or might still be with her, or might at least know where she got to. She spots a contact for Ronan, one of Maddie's ex-boyfriends, and taps the contact to call him. Again, voicemail cuts in without it even ringing, because of course all of Maddie's loser friends will still be sleeping off their hangovers this morning. "Yo, this is me, do the thing after the thing." Adele clenches her jaw, waits for the tone, then forces her voice to be light. "Hey, this is Adele, Maddie's sister. If you're with her, could you get her to give me a call, please? Thanks. Tell her I'm not mad. I'm just checking in." She is mad, of course, and getting madder with every stinking bag she has to deal with. But inflicting her mood on Maddie's friends isn't going to accomplish anything. She scrolls through her contacts, looking for more friends, ex-boyfriends, possible current boyfriends, though Maddie stays pretty tight-lipped about her love life. She says Adele is too judgy, which is true because who wouldn't be judgy about the guys Maddie tends to go for? Laid-back, amiable losers are still losers. She calls a couple more numbers, leaves a couple more messages, then snatches the glove back up off the ground, works her hand back into it, and scans the campsite one last time. Where the f*** are you, Maddie?
The Clearing by Simon Toyne is read by Shaznia Nichols and Hugh Ross and runs for 10 hours, 7 minutes.
On a more literary note, we have the latest book by Zadie Smith, The Fraud, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
A filthy boy stood on the doorstep. He might be scrubbed of all that dirt eventually, but not of so many orange freckles. No more than 14. With skinny, unstable legs like a marionette, he kept pitching forward, shifting soot into the hall. Still, the woman who'd opened the door, easily amused, susceptible to beauty, found she couldn't despise him. "You're from Tobin's?" "Yes, missus, I'm here about sealing. Fell in, didn't it?" "But two men were requested." "All up in London, missus, tiling. Fearsome amount of tiling he's doing in London, madam." He saw, of course, that she was an old woman, but she didn't move or speak like one. A high bosom, handsome, her face had few wrinkles and her hair was black. Above her chin, a half-moon line turned upside down. With such ambiguities were more than the boy could unravel. He deferred to the paper in his hand, reading slowly.
It is 1873. Mrs. Eliza Touché is the Scottish housekeeper and cousin by marriage of a once-famous novelist, now in decline, William Ainsworth, with whom she has lived for 30 years. Mrs. Touché is a woman of many interests, literature, justice, abolitionism, class, her cousin, his wife's, this life and the next. But she's also sceptical. She suspects her cousin of having no talent, his successful friend, Mr. Charles Dickens, of being a bully and a moralist, and England of being a land of facades in which nothing is quite what it seems. Andrew Bogle, meanwhile, grew up enslaved on the Hope Plantation, Jamaica. He knows that every lump of sugar comes at a human cost, that the rich deceive the poor, and that people are more easily manipulated than they realise. When Bogle finds himself in London, witness in a case of imposture, he knows his future depends on telling the right story.
Number one, St. James's Villa, St. James's Road, Tambridge Wells. The name's Touch It, ain't it? From inside the house came a full-throated, ha! The woman didn't flinch. She struck the boy as both canny and hard, like most Scots. All pronunciations of my late husband's name are absurd. I choose to err on the side of France. Now a bearded, well-padded man emerged behind her in the hall, in a dressing gown and slippers, with grey through his whiskers and a newspaper in hand, he walked with purpose towards a bright conservatory. Two King Charles Spaniels followed, barking madly. He spoke over his shoulder, "Cousin, I see you are bored and dangerous this morning," and was gone. The woman addressed her visitor with fresh energy. "This is Mr. Ainsworth's house. I am his housekeeper, Mrs. Eliza Touché. We have a very large hall on the second floor, a crater. The structural integrity of the second floor is in question. But it is a job for two men, at the very least, as I explained in my note." The boy blinked stupidly. Could it really be on account of so many books? "Never you mind what it is on account of. Child, have you recently been up a chimney?" The visitor took exception to child. Tobin's was a respectable firm. He'd done skirting boards in Knightsbridge if it came to that. We was told it was an emergency and not to dawdle. Tradesman's entrance there is, usually. Cheek. But Mrs. Touché was amused.
The Fraud by Zadie Smith is read by the author. and runs for 12 hours, 27 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And next on the show, let's dive into the secret history of fairy tales. Fairy tales are not just fairy tales. They are records of historical phenomena, telling us something about how Western civilization was formed. In The Fairy Tellers, award-winning travel writer Nick Jubber explores their secret history, the people who told them, the landscapes that forged them, and the cultures that formed them. Whilst we are familiar with some of the names entwined in the concept of a fairy tale, such as the Brothers Grimm or Hans Christian Andersen, there are tellers long buried, such as the Syrian storyteller Euhenna Diab and the Wild Sisters of Cassel, without whom we would have never heard of Aladdin, his magic lamp, or the adventures of Hansel and Gretel. The Fairy Tellers, a journey into the secret history of fairy tales, is read by the author, Nicholas Jubber.
With parenthood, fairy tales spilled back into my life for the third time. There's only so many Zogs and lonely donkeys, not-so-scary snorklums and multiple Paw Patrols you can read aloud before you're hankering for the classics. My children's responses fascinated me. My animal-loving youngest identified with the wolf more than with Little Red Riding Hood, and there was a vulpine relish in his delivery of the line, "All the better to eat you with." My Star Wars eager eldest suggested Hansel and Gretel missed a trick by failing to go into the woods armed with lightsabers. In the games that followed, I found myself huffing and puffing over the bunk bed, which had turned into the brick house of the three little pigs, crouching troll-like underneath it, snarling at the trip-trapping of the billy goat's gruff and fee-fi-fo thumbing down the stairs to recover my golden harp from Jack. Occasionally I was pinned by the kind of crafty questions at which children are so preternaturally skilled. "Why are they called fairy tales?" I was asked one afternoon, a pair of button-shaped eyes gleaming over a stack of books, "when fairies don't even have tails." Another time a nose wrinkled over the kitchen table as the words floated over a tub of peanut butter. "Why are there so many witches in fairy tales, but never any wizards?" Gradually, other imaginative vistas lured the children away, and the traditional stories were left behind for dinosaurs and spaceships. But my old fascination had been relit, and I wasn't ready to give them up all over again. It was as if I'd been going back to the same party all through my life, but I'd never found out who had cooked all the delicious food, who'd made the decorations, who'd chosen the song list. It was time to find out who they were and give them thanks.
That was a clip of me, Nicholas Jubber, reading from my book, The Fairy Tellers. It is the story of the secret history behind fairy tales, and it's focusing on the lives of seven particular tellers. There's an Italian soldier of fortune who collected together Europe's first full collection of fairy tales. There's a Syrian draper from the souk of Aleppo who travelled all the way to Paris and told stories like Aladdin and Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. There is an aristocrat from France, a bankrupted aristocrat who wrote down Beauty and the Beast in 1740. There's an apothecary's daughter from Germany who told stories to the Brothers Grimm, such as Rumpelstiltskin and the Six Swans and many others. There's a Russian folklorist who collected many stories about Baba Yaga, the witch in a hut on chicken legs, and many other magical tales, and also got involved in a plot to assassinate the Tsar. There's an Indian courtier who told tales to his queen to soothe her in a time of great trouble in medieval times. And finally, there's Hans Christian Andersen, the famous Danish fairy teller who told and invented many new stories such as the Snow Queen and the Little Mermaid and the Shadow and many others. And so it's about all these lives as a sort of cross-section of the history of fairy tales, hopefully telling the history of the form from medieval times right to the beginnings of the children's publishing industry in the 19th century.
Now, talking of children's publishing and Disney movies, do you think they've been really watered down? Because some of the tales are quite brutal.
Absolutely. When you go back into those original versions, and it's really one of the great things with studying something like the Brothers Grimm stories, for example, is you get lots of different editions and you can see them actually becoming watered down even whilst they themselves were re-editing the stories. Their first earlier versions are much bloodier, much darker. Often the characters that would become stepmothers were in some of the original versions were the mothers. So, for example, the first version of Snow White, which was told by a young woman called Mary Hassenflug to the Brothers Grimm, in the first version, it's the mother who wants to kill Snow White and to eat her livers and her lungs and her heart so that she can absorb her beauty. And then that gets watered down. Slowly she becomes the stepmother, and then that sort of brutal cannibalistic element of it gets taken out of the story as well. And so then by the time you get to the 20th century and you have Disney trying to sort of repackage these stories for a mass audience, the stories are getting more and more diluted, and I think losing a lot of those very interesting and very, very, very exciting elements to them. But it, you know, that's part of a sort of a continuing capitalistic process, which Disney is part of. They're not the only sort of responsible party in that.
Fairy tales stretch back at least 5,000 years, so scientists have declared. According to phylogenetic research, a biological process investigating the roots of language, the origins of stories like Beauty and the Beast and Jack and the Beanstalk can be traced back to the Bronze Age. It's a thrilling thought, linking us to listeners and storytellers across the millennia. But it overlooks something crucial, the stuff that brings the tales to life. It treats the tales as if they came fully formed, prioritising structural roots over the atmosphere and imagery embedded by individual storytellers.
Some of the tales you talked about, even the very first tellings of them, will be familiar. For instance, the tower with the long hair.
Well, there's Cinderella, for example, in Giambattista Basile's collection from the 17th century. There's the story of Cenerentola, and that would become then Cendrillon in French and then Cinderella in English. And it's the story of the skivvy, the girl who has to sort of skivvy for her stepsister and her stepmother, and they go to the ball, and then the fairy godmother turns her into, you know, gives her that makeover and the coach that can take her. And in the original version, by Giambattista Basile, the Neapolitan version, it draws on aspects of the culture of the time, of Naples culture. So you have you have very noisy street scenes. There's not just one party, there's three. There's Italian food, ravioli and ricotta filled pastries at the feasts, and so it feels like you're taken into this sort of time, through the sort of time hole into this particular sort of moment in time. But because these stories have this sort of universal core, they could then be retold and reimagined in different cultures and different times.
How much of the research did you do through travel?
Well, I tried to travel to places connected with each of the storytellers. And so I traveled to Italy and across the Basilicata, the southern region of Italy, where I think a lot of the stories were collected by Giambattista Basile, and met some actors who had been performing sort of some of those old folk tales. I traveled to Denmark and to Lapland in the wake of Hans Christian Andersen, and particularly the story of the Snow Queen, and got to meet some reindeer herders in Lapland and to talk to them about reindeer herding today. And I was trying to sort of connect that with the reindeer in the Snow Queen, and to see how some of those aspects of culture that Andersen brought into his stories, and which he himself researched very, very thoroughly at times, you know, how those have evolved and changed. And I also drew on some earlier travels to places like Kashmir. One of the storytellers in the book is Somadeva, who wrote a book called The Ocean of the Streams of Story, which was in Kashmir, and he was writing in a time of civil war to soothe his queen. And I travelled there a few years ago to the places where that court, where that medieval court was, and had experienced the travelling around the waterways of Srinagar. It's very, you know, you move around by water a lot, and that sort of is an aspect that you find in the landscapes of those stories, the lotus-filled lakes and so on. So I think it was really important to me to be able to connect each storyteller with some sense of having been there and having seen their world, so that you can sort of see the material world that they brought into their stories. Because along with that very universal core that a lot of these very popular stories have, there's also the world that these storytellers inhabited, which very much influenced the way that they told their tales.
Yeah, they would add local items to their tales, basically.
Absolutely, and you see that especially when you compare stories that have that universal appeal, but you can see how each time, each place and time that they're told
they draw on aspects of the culture. So, for example, there's a story from the Indian collection of the Golden City, where the crux of the story is the hero riding on the back of a talking bird, a Garuda in Hindu mythology, and then you find this, and he travels on this talking bird to a magical city of gold, and the story is retold in the 1001 Nights, but there the hero is travelling on a rock, which is a magical bird figure that we find in the tales of Sinbad and many Middle Eastern stories. And the story was even retold by Hans Christian Andersen, but he turned it into the wings of a swan, because that was part of the Nordic culture that he was drawing on. So each time you find these stories changing slightly and evolving, and I find that really exciting, the way that stories can adapt and evolve through geography, but also through time and through the centuries, but somehow retain that recognisable core, which reminds us of how bonded we are with people all around the world and all across time as well.
However vague their opening words may be, fairy tales are rarely located in the timeless zone of everywhere and everywhen. Once upon a time, or in French and German, there was once, there was, there wasn't in Arabic, there is in Sanskrit, is the deceptively non-committal doorway to a world that's often surprisingly particular. Spinning wheels and castles with jigsaw parapets, dark forests haunted by wolves and bears, heroes on horseback and princesses in veiled hennins leaning out of pointed towers. The classic Western fairy tale is time-locked inside a bubble of medieval Europe.
So this was the first audiobook you've narrated. How was that?
Oh, it was really fun. Yeah, really. It was. I mean, it's a long process recording it. But I sometimes think it would be useful to read your book aloud properly when you can still make changes to it. But but it was a really really interesting thing to do. And a lot of these stories, I felt like it was appropriate as well, because a lot of these stories, they came out of oral culture. They're about people telling stories in social settings, or in telling stories to be heard and listened to. So the idea that people will listen to these stories is really exciting. I think that's where these stories are at their absolute most sort of most exciting, I think.
Yes, stories existed long before print ever did.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the story. This is in many ways the story of the transition from oral storytelling to print. And so, as something I mentioned in the book, that each of the storytellers that I wrote about, they were each drawing in some ways on oral culture. Whether it was Giambattista Basile, the Italian storyteller who collected stories, he listened to people who would come when he was working as an administrator in various different courts and regions, and he would listen to the stories that people told him. Or the Brothers Grimm collected stories in their storytelling salon that they had in their home. Or Hans Christian Andersen, who would read his stories aloud to audiences and would tell stories, and enjoyed very much being the storyteller with people gathering around him to listen. So that is a really key part of it.
Some of them can be a bit squeamish. I'm thinking about a certain cockroach.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think those are some of the fun stories which have sort of, you're not going to find them in your anthologies or your collections for the nursery, but they are. I think they're some of the fun ones. And they're also, I think, some of the ones that are fun to tell to an adult audience. I think adults often respond to them. Children respond to some of those squeamish stories very much as well. So The Cockroach, the Mouse and the Cricket is one of my favourite stories by Giambattista Basile. But yeah, he was quite a bawdy writer in many ways. So his stories have a lot of strange and scatological material in them. Yeah.
When postmodernists construct their fairy tale pastiches, from Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods to Shrek to TV series like Once Upon a Time and Disenchanted, they paint their scenes from the same palette. But as we'll see, there are fairy tales all over the world, and they root themselves in their own settings.
The Fairy Tellers by Nicholas Jubber is available both in print and in audio, read by Nick himself. Nicholas, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally on today's show, let's return to Rachel Greenlaw, author of One Christmas Morning, for the books of her life. What Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
I'm going to cheat a little bit here. So there's one author that made me really fall in love with reading and writing, Philip Pullman. I loved his Lyra trilogy, but I also really, really love the Sally Lockhart books, beginning with Ruby in the Smoke, and then The Shadow in the North, Tiger in the Well, and The Tin Princess. I reread those books so many times, my paperbacks fell apart. I just think they were so immersive, so exciting, and I truly adore those books.
On a cold, fretful afternoon in early October 1872, a hansom cab drew up outside the offices of Lockhart and Selby, shipping agents in the financial heart of London, and a young girl got out and paid the driver. She was a person of 16 or so, alone and uncommonly pretty. She was slender and pale, and dressed in mourning with a black bonnet under which she tucked back a straying twist of blonde hair that the wind had teased loose. She had unusually dark brown eyes for one so fair. Her name was Sally Lockhart, and within 15 minutes she was going to kill a man. She stood looking up at the building for a moment, and then climbed the 3 steps and entered. There was a drab corridor facing her with a porter's office on the right, where an old man sat in front of a fire reading a penny dreadful. She tapped on the glass, and he sat up guiltily, thrusting the magazine down beside his chair.
"Beg pardon, miss," he said. "Didn't see you come in."
"I've come to see Mr. Selby," she said. "But he wasn't expecting me."
"Name, please, miss."
"My name is Lockhart. My father was Mr. Lockhart." He became friendlier at once.
"Miss Sally, is it? You've been here before, miss."
"Have I? I'm sorry, I don't remember."
"Must have been 10 years ago, at least. You sat by my fire and had a ginger biscuit and told me all about your pony. You've forgotten already? Dear me, I was very sorry to hear about your father, miss. That was a terrible thing, the ship going down like that. He was a real gentleman, miss."
"Yes, thank you. It was partly about my father that I came. Is Mr. Selby in? Can I see him?"
"Well, I'm afraid he ain't, miss. He's in the West India docks on business. But Mr. Higgs is here, the company secretary, miss. He'll be glad to talk to you."
"Thank you, I'd better see him then." The porter rang a bell, and a small boy appeared, like a sudden solidification of all the grime in the Cheapside air. His jacket was torn in 3 places, his collar had come adrift from the shirt, and his hair looked as if it had been used for an experiment with the powers of electricity.
"What do you want?"
said this apparition, whose name was Jim.
"Mind your manners," said the porter. "Take this young lady up to see Mr. Higgs, and smartish. This is Miss Lockhart."
The boy's sharp eyes took her in for a moment, and then flicked back suspiciously to the porter.
"You got my Union Jack," he said. "I seen you hide it when Higgsy come in earlier."
"I ain't," said the porter, without conviction.
"Get on and do as you're told."
"I'll have it," said the boy.
"You wait, you ain't stealing my property. Come on in,"
he added to Sally, and withdrew.
"You'll have to forgive him, Miss Lockhart," said the porter. "You weren't caught young enough to tame that one."
"I don't mind," said Sally. "Thank you. I'll look in and say goodbye before I go."
The Ruby in the Smoke by Philip Pullman is narrated by Anton Lesser and is available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books, as are all of Philip Pullman's titles. And is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again for a comfort reread?
Oh, there is a book that I would actually really like to listen to on audiobook, because I read it in hardback and I think it would be lovely as an audiobook as well. And that's Spells for Forgetting by Adrienne Young. She writes really lyrically. It's a very autumnal kind of book, and the setting really is brought to life. So I think that that would be my rainy day reread.
I'd grown up being told that the people on the mainland were different from us, but living among them was the first time I really understood it. Mom had gotten better through the years at blending in and appearing at first glance like other mothers. But she still spent the equinox in the woods and the solstice at the sea. She still whispered old words over her teacups, and I'd caught her muttering a curse as we passed the front door of our neighbor's house more than once. It was clear almost as soon as we left Saoirse that she didn't want to talk about the island, that those years would be locked away in some secret place we pretended didn't exist. It wasn't the first time I'd broken my mother's heart. It wasn't the last, either. In a blink, a single moment, every summer in the orchard, every storm over the dark sea, every night in the fishing cabin was entombed inside me like a body beneath a shroud, sealed away from the sunlight. It was for that very reason that I hadn't believed it when I read the handwritten letter folded into the will just days after I watched my mother take her last breath. After so many years of staying away, of never speaking of the place, she'd parted this world with only one wish, that her ashes be buried on Saoirse Island. It had taken me 4 months to actually book a flight to Seattle so I could make good on her request. I'd closed the window shade as we landed, my heart in my throat. I didn't want to see the listless chain of black islands in the distance, or the silvery blue of the water that only existed in the sound. There were things that the taste of the salt-laced wind resurrected, whether I wanted it to or not, and I was already dreading the months or years it would take to put those memories back to bed. My phone buzzed beneath my jacket, and I pulled it from my back pocket, squinting as I read Eric's name on the screen. I let out a heavy exhale before I picked up my pack, hauling it onto one shoulder. I tapped to answer. "Hey,
you make it?"
I pushed through the doors to the ferry's linoleum-floored cabin, where green bucket seats were set in fixed rows. Behind the counter in the corner, a short man with a stained white apron draped over a thick fleece stood awkwardly, watching me over a stainless steel coffee maker. "Just about." I ducked low to glance out the hazy window, where the sunlight was a smear of white on the scratched glass.
"Well, I got your message. All you're really looking for is any important paperwork that might have been left there. You'll need the deed to the house in order to sell it. Titles, marriage licenses, bank accounts, whatever. And we need to get someone local to handle the sale unless you want to get stuck going back and forth to deal with all of this."
Eric's gruff voice on the other end of the line was a tightly pulled tether between this world and another. My simple life in Portland and my less than simple history on Saoirse.
"Any other loose ends there?"
I bit down, following the stark outline of the island with my eyes until it disappeared into the sea.
"No, the orchard was taken care of in Henry's will," I answered, my voice catching just slightly on my grandfather's name.
I hadn't spoken it in years.
"It's just the house, maybe a few pieces of old farm equipment left on the property or something." "When do you have to be back to class?"
Class? I hadn't thought about my classroom on campus for weeks, and the view of the orange-hued wooden risers in the light streaming through the tall arched windows made me feel even farther away.
"Not until next semester. I took a leave to take care of my mom."
"That's right."
His tone shifted just slightly.
"Well, get all this sorted and then get the hell out of there."
Spells for Forgetting by Adrian Young is available commercially as narrated by Ari Liakos, Carrington McDuffie, Dan Bittner, Don Harvey, Emily Rankin, Kimberly Farr, Kirsten Potter, Mark Deakins, and Oliver Wyman. And is there a book you've read recently? Doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Yes, I just finished reading a book that is kind of like a warm hug. It's The Very Secret Society of Irregular Witches by Sangu Mandana. It's just the most lovely book about a character called Micah Moon, who is a witch, and she moves to a very secret house called Nowhere House to mentor three young witches.
As rain dripped steadily down from the cold, muddy grey sky, Primrose cleared her throat.
"How are we all, dears?"
"Wet," Micah couldn't resist pointing out.
"Your contribution is noted, thank you, Poppet,"
said Primrose, unperturbed. We're pretending to be a book club, Primrose. Mika replied, exasperated. We don't need to hide in the middle of nowhere. Why couldn't we just meet for a sodding coffee somewhere with central heating?
I, for one, think our safety is worth more than our comfort,
Primrose said, and then went straight for the jugular. But considering the most irregular way you spend your time, dear, I am not in the least surprised that you don't seem to feel the same way. Mika sighed. She'd walked right into that one. At 31, she was a rather young witch in a group that mostly skewed older. While she didn't exactly have a handy spreadsheet with each witch's age on it, she was quite sure that she, Hilda Kim and Sophie Clark, were the only ones this side of 40, so she should perhaps have been a lot more intimidated by Primrose than she actually was. But the truth was, she knew Primrose a lot better than most of the other witches here, and she and Primrose had had a wobbly relationship since before Mika could remember. The problem, really, was that witches were always orphans. According to Primrose, this was because of a spell that went wrong in some bygone era. Mika was certain this tale was a figment of Primrose's imagination, but she also had no better explanation because the fact remained. When a witch was born, she would find herself orphaned shortly thereafter. It didn't matter where in the world the witch was born, and the cause of death could be anything from innocuous illnesses to everyday accidents. But it was inevitable. Some witches were then raised by grandparents or other relatives, and in time came to discover the existence of their own magic. All things considered, assuming that they weren't catastrophically reckless with their spell work, they grew up to lead quite normal lives. But some witches, like Mika, were the daughters of witches. And some of those witches, like Mika, were also the granddaughters of witches. It was unusual, certainly. Most witches, only too mindful of the axe over their heads, chose not to have children of their own, but it did sometimes happen. And so, when Mika Moon, the orphaned child of an orphaned child of an orphaned child, found herself left in the care of an overworked social worker in India in the early 90s, Primrose found her, brought her to England and deposited her in a perfectly proper, comfortable home with perfectly proper, comfortable nannies.
The Very Secret Society of Irregular Witches by Sangu Mandana is available commercially as narrated by Samara McLaren. And once again, Rachel Greenlaw, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on today. It's been absolutely lovely chatting with you.
All we've got time for on today's show. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 350 episodes in our podcast feed. Just type Read On, RNIB, into your favourite podcast app.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.